and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today we are going to get into the third and final part of Captain Scott's Discovery Expedition. And as always, I am joined by Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk some more about Captain Robert Falcon Scott of the Antarctic. We'll start with a recap. Last episode, we learned how the Discovery was built out of wood rather than steel and loaded with food, gallons of alcohol, a library, and a piano. We learned of the danger involved during blizzards of snow and how one man had already died, while another fell asleep and woke up 36 hours later without even frostbite after the snow had covered him over. We'd heard how they could get so exhausted they would just fall inside the tent and crawl into the reindeer skin sleeping bags. Other times they would have the energy to undress, keeping new clothes tight to their bodies during the day so that they didn't freeze. The inside of the tent would get iced up with the condensation from breath, and sweat would turn into ice underneath them while they were sleeping. In the morning, they would emerge one by one, facing the wind, wait for a lull, and do what had to be done, leading to one's clothes filling with snow and a cold, wet bottom for the next few hours. I mean, it's quite horrific living conditions that they were under. They've been there for about a year. And we'll learn today about what happened on some of these reconnaissance missions, and also about the boat that came to see them. So, is there anything else that you wanted to add to that, Max? Anything that you wanted to pick up on that we were talking about last time?
Well, the thing that was impressed upon me most last time was the graphic descriptions of the difficulties that the crew had in terms of dealing with the extreme cold. And you've sort of touched on it a bit again with regard to, you know, freezing sweat and all this sort of thing. And I on the one hand was thinking just how awful it would be to actually have to live like that, but on the other hand my mind was thinking how sort of comic some of the aspects of it, you know, were with regard to, you know, people sleeping three in a sleeping bag, and every time one moved it disturbed the others and all this sort of thing, and having to keep your pairs of socks tucked inside your underwear so that they didn't freeze up and they were kept warm enough and supple enough to be able to put the socks on and all that kind of thing. It's just amazing, really, that people, you know, in those days, and you know, still there are some people today that have got enough about them to be prepared to sort of undergo the same sort of privations in the interests of science or whatever. It's just, you know, it's just very impressive that some people are prepared to do that.
And they would have, obviously, they would have kept the morale up and the sense of humour as well. Well, on September the 17th, 1902, Scott went on a preliminary reconnaissance with Barne and Shackleton. On the second night, a blizzard came up and nearly took their tent away, as they had neglected to pile enough snow around the outside. And before they made it back to the ship, all had suffered frostbite. Many sledging trips took place over the spring and the early summer. On November the 2nd, Scott, Wilson and Shackleton set forth on their southern journey together with a large supporting party under Barne. This was to be the centrepiece of the expedition, but soon after leaving they were slowed by sticky snow and deep sastrugi. And sastrugi are features formed in the snow by the wind. When you see like great sharp snowdrifts, they look like that's what sastrugi is, and you get great cracks and crevices, they turn into ice, and that's when you get the crevices. A two-day blizzard kept them in their tent, and on the third day Shackleton started to cough. Beyond Minna Bluff they were into the unknown and already appeared to be lost on the great open plain. At the 79th parallel, photographs were taken and half of Barne's supporting party turned back. The rest pushed on until November the 15th, at which time the balance of Barne's party took for home. And remember, because we're on the other side of the earth here, it's obviously the summertime in November and December rather than the winter. So Barne's parties took off for home, but from the very next day, things began to go wrong. The major problem came with the dogs. Instead of bringing dog biscuit to feed them, dried stockfish had been brought. The stockfish had become tainted as the Discovery sailed through the tropics, and now the dogs wouldn't eat it. From November the 16th onwards, Scott's diary makes sad reading, with the dogs daily losing heart and condition, and the men's hopes of making a heroic journey slowly fading away. There was nothing they could do but to press on as far south as they could, and when the dogs could do no more hauling, they simply would do the hauling themselves. They would have been better off just killing the dogs and depositing the meat as they sledged south, but they went on, somehow hoping that the dogs would revive. This really speaks to, you know, the love that we have for animals, really, and how they become a man's best friend, because that's really what they should have done. But they didn't. On November the 25th, the party became the first to cross the 80th parallel, beyond which all maps were blank. And we have a quote here. "It has always been our ambition to get inside that white space, and now we are there, so the space can no longer be a blank. This compensates for a lot of trouble." Close quote. Hunger now became a problem with the men, as rations were significantly reduced in order to preserve what little food they had left. "We cannot stop, we cannot go back, and there is no alternative but to harden our hearts and drive," Scott wrote. "Certainly dog driving is the most terrible work one has to face in this sort of business." On December the 5th, Scott wrote, "The events of the day's march are now becoming so dreary and dispiriting that one longs to forget them when we camp. It is an effort even to record them in a diary. Our utmost efforts could not produce more than 3 miles for the whole march." 5 days later, the first dog died. The other dogs pounced on the fallen animal and ate the corpse. After this, the team decided to try and save the best 9 dogs by feeding them the flesh of the others. Wilson volunteered for the job of butchering, as Scott considered the job a moral cowardice of which I am heartily ashamed. The victim was led away, with tail wagging, as the others howled in anticipation of the meal to come. Scott wrote, "We can only keep them on the move by constant shouting. This devolves on me. Stripes and Brownie doing absolutely nothing and vomiting. Poor old Granny pulled till she could pull no longer and lay down in the snow. They put her on a sledge and she soon died. The dogs take away all idea of enjoying the marches." I mean, that's an awful situation that they're in. Mm. I mean, who was it that didn't check that they'd actually brought the dog biscuits? They brought the wrong food instead. Basically, that was the cause of this. And of course, they couldn't go back once they had started.
And I suppose some people think that dogs will eat anything, but dogs don't actually, won't actually eat anything. As anybody who's kept dogs will know, that dogs sometimes can be a bit picky about what they eat, and certainly wouldn't want to eat something that was rotten.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they would actually eat other dogs. But I guess if they're absolutely starving, they've got to survive. More problems appeared, as Dr. Wilson noted that Shackleton's gums were swollen, the first sign of scurvy. Portions of seal meat were increased, but, quote, "hunger is gripping us very tightly." On December the 20th, Wilson lay awake all night from sheer hunger, and on December the 26th, snow blindness was bothering Wilson's eyes so badly that he finally told Scott. The next day, he hauled his sledge blindfolded, and Scott described to him the mountains that were coming into view. Within sight was a huge peak, which was larger than any mountain they had seen thus far. They estimated its height at 13,000 feet and named it Mount Markham, obviously after the originator of the trip, the guy that got the whole trip together. Scott decided to turn for home on December the 31st, having reached 82 by 17 degrees south. They had travelled 300 miles further south than anyone before them and were only 480 statute miles from the pole. A dog a day was dropping dead or being slaughtered. Bismarck was killed on January the 4th, Boss dropped behind and was never seen again, and when Kid died, they gave up trying to drive the rest and instead set them free to follow on behind. When they were down to 1 day's rations, Scott pulled out his telescope and spotted the depot left on the outward march. Meanwhile, Shackleton's scurvy symptoms had reappeared. His throat was congested, his breath short, his gums were red and swollen, and he started to split blood. Now there were only 2 men to pull the sledges, as Shackleton could only walk beside them in order to avoid too much exertion. Well, yeah, think about that. I mean, he's they've only got two men left to pull the sledges, and he can only walk alongside them. This shows that Scott was the correct guy to lead this mission, because he's one of the only ones that are left that aren't snow blind and hasn't got scurvy and is still able to lead. So it really points to him being the right choice to lead the mission here. And I'd always associated scurvy with something to do with the tropics, not in the Arctic or in the Antarctic. But I guess I think
it's a lack of vitamin C causes it, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I'm not sure maybe why I thought it happened in the tropics, but it's a lack of fruit. So I guess, yeah, you shouldn't have a lack of fruit in the tropics, should you? But they used to get it on the ships, didn't they? When they were just eating the ship's biscuit.
It'd be on a ship that's in the middle of the Pacific or the middle of the Atlantic, where there's no access to fruit. Ah. So ships, in order to prevent scurvy, would have had crates of limes and oranges on them. But if the crates of limes and oranges, for whatever reason, had gone mouldy or whatever, then they could be out at sea for, you know, 2 or 3 months with no vitamin C, and in a situation where scurvy could set in, irrespective of the latitude that the ship occupied as far as the planet is concerned.
Right. So, yeah, same situation. No fresh fruit around. On January the 18th, 1903, Shackleton completely gave out, which forced them to camp for a number of days. And finally, on January 28th, they reached Depot A, only 60 miles from the ship. At length and at last, we have reached the land of plenty. Close quote. With Shackleton aboard one of the sledges, the team set off the next day and sledged 15 miles. On February 2nd, White Island came into view, and Scott wrote, "We are as near spent as three persons can be." On February 3rd, Skelton and Bonacci came out and greeted them. Soon they were back on the ship with handshakes and congratulations coming from all. They had been gone for 93 days and had covered 960 statute miles. And I guess this would have been one of the situations when the champagne came out, having made it into that blank spot on the map for the first time ever.
Yes.
And then supplies arrived. The Morning, commanded by William Colbeck, had left Littleton on December the 6th, 1902. And on January the 24th, 1903, she made fast with ice anchors to the floe off Hut Point. A party from the Morning delivered bags of mail, and Royds alone had 62 letters and a cake. But all the talk was whether the 8 or 9 miles of ice that penned in the Discovery would break up and be carried out to sea in time for her to return with the Morning to Littleton. Colbeck could not risk leaving any later than the end of February, and by February the 10th, it appeared the Discovery would not break free as new ice was forming. On February the 22nd, they tried blowing holes in the ice with explosives to crack the floes, but this didn't work. By the 25th, Scott accepted the fact that the Morning would have to leave without them or risk being trapped itself. 14 tons of stores were offloaded onto the ice, along with 20 tons of coal, with the crew of the Morning sledging them halfway, at which point they met the Discovery crew, who finished the sledging back to Hut Point. The Morning had one other primary purpose to fulfil: to remove any members of the expedition who wished to return to civilization. 8 men applied to return with the ship, but Scott struggled with how to handle Shackleton. In his diary, he wrote that on board he would have remained a source of anxiety, as he would never have been able to do hard outdoor work. Dr. Koetlitz then put his opinion in writing: "Mr. Shackleton's breakdown during the southern sledge journey was undoubtedly, in Dr. Wilson's opinion, due in great part to scurvy taint. I certainly agree with him. He has now practically recovered from it, but referring to your memo as to the duties of an executive officer, I cannot say that he would be fit to undergo hardships and exposure in this climate." And Shackleton went home. So, that's one of the important ones. Yeah, one of the important ones that's gone back, but we do know that he would go back out there and lead his own expedition. There is much controversy over this decision, as rumours were in circulation that Scott had other reasons for sending Shackleton home. Armitage disagreed with Scott's decision, and bitterness towards Scott grew through the years that followed. Before the departure of the morning, Scott went so far as to suggest that Armitage go home to be with his wife and a child that he had never seen. Armitage was offended and insulted at this, and later wrote, "I had been told that Sir Clements Markham intended to make the expedition a great Royal Navy one only, but all went well with me for the first year. When Scott thought that he had enough experience to go on his own, he had not. Then he endeavoured to rid himself of all the merchant service element. When he, in a most kindly manner, suggested that I should return in the morning, I absolutely refused. But he never forgave me, as not only did I destroy the Royal Navy idea, but he feared that I would obtain kudos, which he desired." It was, in fact, Armitage who never forgave Scott. So this is really the first time that we've heard about this rivalry between the merchant service and the Navy. And this is because Scott has already made it into this white patch on the map, and he wanted Armitage to go back. And Armitage is thinking, well, no, I want to stay because I want to continue, and so that they can say that the Merchant Navy got there as well as the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Amazing that those sort of rivalries existed, but I suppose that. In those days, merchant shipping was a very difficult and arduous business to be in, and probably just as dangerous in some ways as being within the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy perhaps would have been easier than the merchant the life of a merchant sailor in some respects. And so each would have viewed the other with a certain amount of rivalry, I suppose.
And small things would have been niggling at them as well. If you're living in the company of the same people for a year, small things are probably starting to get to them, which obviously they would try to avoid. Sometimes you just can't help it. Once it was realised that the morning would sail alone, because the Discovery was stuck in the ice, all the men got busy writing letters. On March the 1st, 1903, there was a farewell party on the morning, which went on for half the night. The next morning, the morning set sail. Shackleton shed tears as he watched his friends and shipmates drop out of sight. In his place, Sub-Lieutenant George Mulock, aged 21, transferred to the Discovery. The winter of 1903 set in earlier and was much colder than the year before. Sledging plans were made for the following season, while resentment grew between Scott and Armitage. Royds wanted to go back to Cape Crozier to look for more penguin eggs, while Armitage wanted to go south across the barrier, more or less in Scott's footsteps. Royds wrote, "In my opinion, his sole wish is to beat the captain's record. This the captain wouldn't allow, though not for that reason, by any means." This put Scott in an awkward position. If he refused, Armitage would charge that Scott wanted to keep the furthest south record to himself and not let a subordinate have a go. This raised the question with Scott, are they there to do scientific and discovery work, or are they there to compete for a dash to the South Pole? Scott clearly felt that it was the first named objective. Scott could find no purpose in allowing Armitage to make a dash to the south, as he felt that without dogs, Armitage would be fortunate to get as far as he had, and would only be risking death for himself and his party. It simply made no sense to Scott. Wilson wrote, "The captain worked out the possibilities on paper and showed them to me, and I agreed with him in thinking it was far better to apply all our sledging energies to new work, rather than covering old ground with a chance of doing so little at the end of it. The upshot of it all is that Armitage is off the sledging list for this year altogether, although whether this is due to himself or anyone else, I cannot say." And Armitage's resentment only deepened after that. It's a difficult one, really, but I mean, should they keep going with the risk, or now that they've already been into that white patch? What do you think, Max? Should they have carried on going, allowed him to have a go at it?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult at this sort of distant point historically to make a judgment, I suppose. It's it would be impossible to say, I think, from a modern perspective. You'd have to be there. You know, it's like one of these things that you've got to be there to understand the conditions and to understand the pros and cons of each different option, really.
It was a point of contention for the rest of Armitage's life that he wasn't allowed to keep going, but they had already got there. It is a really difficult one, but they also had all this scientific work to do, and to have somebody just retrace their steps just so that they could go a few miles more is really a waste of manpower. So I think I support Scott on this one. I think he made the right choice. On August 21st, 1903, the rim of the sun appeared for the first time over the horizon. The sledging plans were pinned to the notice board with instructions for everyone to return and be back on board the Discovery by December the 15th, so that all hands could work together to free the ship, if possible, before the return of the morning. So they're all going to be gone for 3 months there. There were to be two major ventures, each with a supporting party to lay depots and then return. Scott was to go west up the Ferrar Glacier as far as he could get. Balm was to explore an inlet south of McMurdo Strait. The first to leave the ship on September the 7th were Royds, Wilson and four men bound for Cape Crozier. The journey was rather uneventful as eggs and two live chicks were collected. On the trip back to the ship, the temperatures fell to minus 61 Fahrenheit, which resulted in significant frostbite among the men, but they arrived back at the ship without any further hardship. On September 9th, Scott set out with Skelton and four others to lay a depot in preparation for the ascent of the Western Mountains. Meanwhile, Barnes' party was out on the barrier laying a depot southeast of White Island, where the mercury in their thermometer dropped to minus 67.7 Fahrenheit and then broke. Scott's team left for their main journey on October the 12th. With four sledges hauling 200 pounds per man, they reached New Harbour and dragged their loads up the Ferrar Glacier to a basin at about 4,500 feet. But the runners on the sledges had become damaged to the point that the whole team had to turn around and travel 87 miles all the way back to the ship for repairs. 5 days later, they started out again. And this time they succeeded in struggling to the top of the mountains, where they were then caught in a blizzard that nearly buried them alive. It was the most miserable week of his life, Scott wrote. They spent 22 out of every 24 hours in their sleeping bags for a whole week, only climbing out long enough to get the cooker going and eat a hot meal. On November 14th, they reached the summit at 8,900 feet, where they found themselves on a flat plain, and for the next 2 weeks they sledged due west. A constant icy wind produced raw and bleeding lips, and Lashley wrote, "The wind seems to be very troublesome here." On December 1st, the team turned back, and Scott wrote, "I don't know where we are, but I know we must be a long way to the west. As long as I live, I never want to revisit the summit of Victoria Land." He was disappointed to find that it was just an endless plateau, nearly 9,000 feet above sea level.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite harsh stuff, isn't it? You imagine they've lost the dogs, so they've got to drag the sledges themselves. And then when they get to just at the start of the mission, they discover that the sledge rails are broken and they've got to take them back. And you've also got to remember that they were supposed to be leaving with the morning, when the morning got there. But the Discovery had got wedged in the ice and they didn't want to leave the ship. So they stayed with the ship, they've got extra supplies, and they're going to spend another year doing scientific work without dogs, basically.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and how would you get a message back to Britain? You've got to remember, they didn't have radio at this time. You know, they couldn't message base and say, we're going to need more dogs along with the supplies. So when the morning arrived, it didn't have dogs with them. They didn't think that they might need a replacement team of huskies to drag the sledges. They just brought them the food and mail.
Yeah, at 9,000 feet, you know, it's mentioned in there, I think that 15,000 feet is normally the point where the air starts to become really thin and you start to need to use extra oxygen. But at 9,000 feet, perhaps in those cold conditions, that would have exacerbated their ability to absorb oxygen as well. So there's lots of different things that could have been affecting them and making life more difficult than one might have thought.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time they've really been in these sorts of conditions. It's all completely new for man to be in conditions where it's so cold that the thermometer breaks. And, you know, imagine the wind chill as well. If it's that bad that they had to spend 22 hours inside the tent for a week and they could only go out for 2 hours a day. I mean, it must have been absolutely freezing cold. And they got frostbite as well. They're cooking in the tent. They're actually having to have the cooker in the tent. So, you know, the fumes from that can't have been any good either. Unless they had a hole in the top, I should imagine. But if they had a hole in the top, that's going to let the that's going to let the snow in. I guess the heat from the fire would have evaporated the snow if they had a hole in the top of the tent. But they haven't actually mentioned that. Maybe they had proper tents with a metal bit with a flue pipe that was actually going up. But then that's a lot of weight to carry. And all these things you've got to think about. I mean, all we can really say is that this is, you know, these are some really tough guys.
Really tough. Absolutely.
Really tough. And being the first to actually get to this far south. And when you think of the south, you don't think of the cold either, do you? You think of the warmth. You think of Australia. You don't think of
minus
it like
67
this.
Degrees, 67.768. Yeah. That's, cold enough without special adaption, you probably wouldn't last more than about 10 minutes at that sort of a temperature. And so, you know, the clothing that they were wearing, all the precautions they had to take were in order to keep them alive, and they could die very quickly if any of their equipment started to fail.
Yeah, they're very lucky, really, that they've only lost one man so far, and that was that was falling off a cliff edge and into the sea, along with some of the dogs right back at the beginning. So they've done pretty well just to lose one man so far. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons for today then, Max? We finished with that,
yes,
do you think?
Yes, that sounds like a good idea.
Let's get into our Greatest Briton for the week. Once again, it is Captain Robert Falcon Scott of the Antarctic, and we will begin with a recap of the last episode where we heard how Scott and his team became the first to cross into the blank space on the map, but they lost all their dogs in the process due to losing the dog food and taking rotten fish with them instead. Rather than waste a man sending someone to the same spot to try and go further, Scott decided it would be better to concentrate on the other parts of the mission, which induced resentment in Armitage, who thought this was down to him being a merchant navy man, while Scott was from the Royal Navy. Ernest Shackleton got scurvy, and rather than risk him catching it again, it was decided that he should go back with the supply ship when she arrived, marking a full year spent in the Antarctic. The Discovery was stuck tight in the ice, and rather than abandon her, the team decided to stay for another year, and we left Scott and his men at the summit of Victoria Land, which they discovered was just an endless plateau, nearly 900 feet above sea level. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that for those people that were there, it must have, and I suppose for people that have taken part in similar expeditions since, going to Antarctica is almost like going to a different world. It's a world where the landscape is entirely different, where the environment is entirely different. And that's quite it's quite an awesome prospect to behold, going to a place like that. And, knowing that you've got to venture into that strange environment further than anybody else has ever ventured before.
Yeah, the first people to get there, rather like being at the bottom of the ocean or being on the surface of the moon. Well, continuing with our narrative here, it was now a familiar story. Hunger, exhaustion, deep sastrugi, the snowdrifts in the ice, fog, snowdrifts, frostbite and snow blindness. Food ran short and the oil was nearly gone. On December the 14th, Scott faced the fact that they were lost. They had reached the edge of the plateau and were beginning to descend when Lashley slipped and started to slide on his back down the slope. In the process, he took the legs out from under the others, and down they went, sledge and all. And when they came to a halt, they were stunned to find themselves at the head of the glacier, in familiar territory, only 5 or 6 miles from their depot. And miraculously, there were no broken bones. In Lashley's words, all of a sudden, the captain and Evans disappeared down a crevasse and carried away one of the sledge runners, leaving me on top. It was now my duty to try and get them up again. Scott and Evans were left dangling with blue walls of ice on either side and nothingness below. Remarkably, Scott was able to swing his feet around and grip the wall with his crampons. Using the last of his strength, Scott was able to climb out to safety while Lashley pulled Evans up, whose only comment was, "Well, I'm blowed." That night, quite a shock there. That night, they reached the depot, and 8 days later, on Christmas Eve, they reached the ship. In 59 days, they had hauled their sledge 725 miles. So don't forget, they've lost the dogs now. They're having to pull the sledges themselves. I mean, that must have been quite a rush of adrenaline there. You imagine you're just left there dangling over the side, and you've got to swing yourself into that wall of ice and get your crampons in and then try to pull yourself back up. You know, you've got to use all your strength, and they're in what, you know, freezing temperatures here, minus 40, minus 50. Very, very lucky to not have any broken bones after that. Well, only 4 men were at the ship to greet them when they arrived, as the others were out on the ice 10 miles away, soaring and blasting at it in the hope of breaking it up to a point where the Discovery could finally be freed. Scott was pleased that all the sledging trips had returned safely, and on the Western Mountains, Ferrar had discovered a fossil leaf, and Wilson was pleased with the results of his penguin expedition. They went looking for penguin eggs. By the end of December, Scott would write, 20 miles of ice hangs heavy on me, as he knew he had to start preparations for a third winter at Hut Point. On January the 5th, 1904, a ship came into view. It was the Morning, and a few minutes later, Wilson exclaimed, "Why, there's another!" Wilson wrote, "We were dumbfounded." Wilson and Scott set off for the two ships and were subsequently greeted at the edge of the ice by 4 men speaking such perfect Dundee that we could hardly understand a word that they said. They were from the second ship, the Terra Nova. Soon Wilson and Scott were aboard the Morning receiving their mail and questioning their old friend William Colbeck as to why 2 relief ships were at anchor in McMurdo Sound. When the Morning returned from the Antarctic in 1903, Markham was delighted with the news of Scott's expedition, but he realised that clearly a second relief expedition would be necessary. Unfortunately, there was little money left, so together with Sir William Huggins, Markham appealed to the government for a grant of £12,000. Markham knew all along that a second relief expedition would be necessary, but this was a fact he had concealed from the government when the original plans were laid. The government felt misled and promptly took the matter out of the hands of the societies. If left up to Markham and his group, the government felt they would find an excuse to leave them on the ice for yet another year. The government would take no chances, as the goal would be to get the men home safe and sound, even if it meant abandoning the Discovery. On June the 20th, 1903, the government agreed to pay for the relief expedition, provided the Morning was handed over absolutely and at once, free of charge, to the Admiralty. Reluctantly, both societies agreed, and the Morning now had new owners. Sir William Wharton, the hydrographer, was appointed by the Admiralty as chairman to the newly formed Antarctic Relief Committee. So the government have had to set up an Antarctic Relief Committee, sort of unbeknownst to Scott and the rest of them, who did not want to leave their ship and were thinking, well, we'll have just have to stay here until the ship is freed. But the government are saying, no, we're not having that. You're going to have to come home, lads. We can't leave you out there all this time. Now, the government took an odd position. Wharton wrote, "It cannot be considered as certain that the Morning could get through single-handed, and a second vessel, if a suitable one could be found, would be a great additional safeguard." This decision by the Admiralty came on June the 22nd, 1903, which gave them little more than 4 months to locate, refit, and get her to Lyttelton by mid-November. Wharton investigated resources all over Europe in an attempt to find a worthy whaling vessel that could accomplish the goal, and it was from St. John's, Newfoundland, that the suggestion came to purchase the Terra Nova. She was considerably larger than the Morning, at 744 tons and 187 feet in length, and she came at a hefty price. She was purchased on July the 6th for £20,000, some £17,200 more than Markham had paid for the Morning, and well above her appraised value. Try as they might, by the time she was ready to sail, it was simply too late in the season for the Terra Nova to reach New Zealand on her own, and still leave enough time to make McMurdo Sound. So Wharton instructed her to be towed by naval vessels as far as the Persian Gulf, from where she would continue on under her own sail and steam. HMS Minerva towed her from Portsmouth to Gibraltar, HMS Vindictive took her on to Aden, and from there HMS Fox towed her to an area 120 miles off the east coast of Socotra, where she was left on her own for the final leg. The Terra Nova abandoned plans to meet the Morning in Lyttelton, as it was closer to sail directly to Hobart, Tasmania, and meet up with her there. The two ships met in Hobart on October 31st, and together they departed for McMurdo Sound. And it's interesting they still had these great big whaling ships back then. I should imagine that the actual resources from the whale were really useful. All that blubber, all that oil for lamps. I mean, we forget that whales themselves were a massive resource to us in the past, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But the story as you're telling it sort of shows really the immense logistical challenge that getting a ship down to the Antarctic presented, even though this is a rescue mission, it still requires immense resources. It still requires a tremendous amount of planning, the rescue mission is can be considered just as demanding and just as challenging as the actual expedition itself in some ways.
And I think the men themselves were quite embarrassed by this as well. Scott and his fellow officers were not only dismayed but insulted by the arrival of the Terra Nova along with the Morning. They had no idea of the problems encountered by Markham in England, but one thing they knew for certain, one ship was all that was needed, and to send two implied that they were in deep trouble and unable to handle things on their own. Scott wrote, "It was not a little trying to be offered relief to an extent which seemed to suggest that we have been reduced to the direst need. No healthy man likes to be thought of as an invalid." Scott was very concerned that his career would be jeopardised. After all, if found an incompetent commander by his superiors, he might as well forget any promotion upon their return. Ironically, the government seemed concerned that the expedition might be having too good a time. To them, it made no sense to have their officers and men remain indefinitely in the Antarctic on full pay, all the while feasting on seals and provisions sent at great expense in an annual relief ship. In July 1903, the government could not consent to the officers and men of the Royal Navy being employed in any further expedition in the ice, even if sufficient private funds were raised for such a purpose, and that Commander Scott will receive directions to this effect. These directions were given to Colbeck, commander of the Terra Nova. To make matters even worse, instructions were given to Colbeck to have the Discovery abandoned if she could not be freed from the ice. Scott was furious. In normal conditions, a sailor would go through much rather than abandon his ship, but the ties which bound us to the Discovery were far beyond the ordinary, Scott wrote. She was dearly loved by her crew. She had been their home for 2.5 years. She was considered the finest ship ever built for such a task, and to abandon her would be like a broken marriage. It may not have been their fault, but the men would have returned as castaways, with the sense of failure dominating the results of our labours. 20 miles of ice separated the ship from open water in mid-January. Captain Mackey of the Terra Nova felt the departure date should not extend beyond February the 25th, 1904, and Colbeck agreed. Blasting and soaring proved useless, so nothing was left but to pray for southeasterly gales. Aboard the Discovery, Scott read the Admiralty's instructions to his crew, and there was a strong, stony silence. I had not heard a laugh in the ship since I returned. And this is really quite serious, isn't it? Because, I mean, they're seeing this as really embarrassing if they have to leave the ship there. And these are the sort of things that you don't think about when you first hear about this. The crew began the difficult task of transferring all the scientific collections and equipment to the Morning and the Terra Nova. For the next 5 weeks, the ice slowly began to break up. An all-out attack on the ice was put into gear. Explosives, saws and everything imaginable was used in an attempt to free the ship. On January 27th, Scott wrote, I much fear things are going badly for us. Royds wrote, it is perfectly sickening. Why doesn't it break up? What the devil is holding it? The prospects are as cheerless as they could be, and I could simply scream at our absolute helplessness. The thermometer fell to minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit. By February 3rd, Royds wrote, things look hopeless. Everything is at a standstill. On February 12th, Royds wrote, as I write, the Terra Nova is now only 2 miles away and the ice continues to break away. The ice was simply rushing out in huge lumps and flows, every blast sending more out and cracking well behind. So suddenly the tide has turned here for them. Now they worked harder than ever to free the ship as destiny was in the balance. St. Valentine's Day saw the break they needed as Scott and others raced up to Hut Point and noted that the ice was breaking up right across the strait and with a rapidity which we had not thought possible. I have never witnessed a more impressive sight. The sun was low behind us, the surface of the ice sheet in front was intensely white, and in contrast the distant sea and its forking leads looked almost black. The wind had fallen to a calm, and not a sound disturbed the stillness about us. Yet in the midst of this peaceful scene was an awful unseen urgency, rending that great ice sheet as though it had been naught but the thinnest paper. Now without a word, without an effort on our part, it was all melting now, and we knew that in an hour or two not a vestige of it would be left, and that the open sea would be lapping on the black rocks of Hut Point. I mean, this makes it really clear that the climate fluctuates, doesn't it? They spent 2 years there, frozen, totally frozen in the ice, and on the third year it melts, and they're finally going to be able to get out. And no doubt in the fourth year it would have all frozen up again. The relief ships butted their way side by side to the Discovery. The men cheered as the Terra Nova broke through the last sheet of ice at 10:30 p.m. and freed the Discovery. A few days were hurriedly spent preparing the ships for departure, and in memory to George Vince, a final emotional ceremony was held on the ice, and a wooden cross was erected to mark his grave. And remember, that's the one man of the crew that ended up dying right at the start of the expedition.
Yeah.
Despite a difficult departure to open water, the three ships finally were underway, leaving McMurdo Sound on February 19th, 1904. Scott decided to take the Discovery around Cape Adare and explore to the west along the northern coast of Victoria Land. The Morning was to head straight for the Auckland Islands, where the three ships would rendezvous and sail together to Lyttelton. After 2 years in the ice, the Discovery was far from seaworthy. Water poured into the holds, the pumps wouldn't work, gales came up, and subsequently everyone got seasick since they'd been landlocked for so long. The rudder was in such poor shape, that it was ready to fall off. They had a spare, but it was only half as big. I mean, how are they going to get that on? They're going to have to go over the side to change it?
And hold their breath and go under there.
Crazy. The further west they went, the thicker the ice became. Becoming short of coal, the ship turned north to find open water so they could use the sails. By this time, she had lost touch with the Terra Nova, and of course, they didn't have wireless radios at this time either. She was pushed so far north that she missed land altogether and instead rediscovered the Bellini Islands. On March the 14th, they reached the Auckland Islands with only 10 tons of coal left aboard. Neither of the other ships were there, so while they waited, some of the crew cleaned and painted the ship, while others went ashore and shot anything that looked edible, including wild cattle and pigs. The New Zealand government also maintained a depot of emergency supplies for the use of shipwrecked sailors, called by the sealers Sarah's Bosom. the other vessels. Do you want to add anything there, Max? Any thoughts on that?
No, no, he's just really called by the saying of Sarah's bosom.
Yeah, it's a good name, isn't it? Welcoming name for them to come across. The other vessels showed up a few days later, and after 3 days sailing, on Good Friday, April 1st, 1904, they reached Littleton Harbour. There was a wonderful welcoming party, and guests and reporters swarmed the ships. Unfortunately, a remark made by Scott in a crowd was overheard by a reporter who took the comment totally out of context and falsely reported the incident. What a surprise. The men of the Discovery were in total agreement concerning the absurdity of sending the Terra Nova to rescue them. The story published by a Reuters reporter made headlines in England. Commander Scott emphatically protests against the dispatch by the Admiralty of the Terra Nova, which he declares to have been a wasteful expense of money. He says that had the proper position of the Discovery been made known, it would have been obvious that she was perfectly safe, and no assistance beyond that which the morning could render was requisite. Scott felt his goose was cooked when it came to a promotion. Even Royds commented, although it was the truth, he never said it. Back home, matters weren't much better. Together with his brother-in-law, Scott was still supporting his mother. His two sisters were having a difficult time in the dressmaking industry. As his mother wrote, it is really a bad season and no money going. Scott felt that if he was not promoted, a certain life of poverty would return. He wrote to his mother from New Zealand, "If they wait till we get home, then two or three persons will inevitably leap over my head. The question is whether they will pass me over in June. It is such a close thing that it must make a great deal of difference." So we sort of forget about the personal issues that were going on while they were away. Meanwhile, the ship was in need of repairs, and yet money was so tight that Scott only paid the regular crew members while the officers were left to fend for themselves. Everybody wrote home from Littleton. Royds and Wilson wrote to Scott's mother, Hannah, telling her how proud they were of her son's efforts. Wilson wrote, "Without a doubt, he has been the making of the expedition, and not one of us will but feel more and more grateful to him for the way he has acted throughout. Notwithstanding that it is a difficult thing, at least I imagine it is, for the captain to make intimate friends with anyone, I feel as though we were real friends, and I need hardly say I am proud of it." The Discovery was placed in dry dock for 2 months to complete repairs. Meanwhile, Scott was wined and dined by the dignitaries all over the island. He wrote to his mother, "We have had a very good time here, but it is high time we were off, as all our young men are getting engaged. Skelton is actually caught. I believe the young lady is very nice." The young lady was Sybil. Others were caught as well, Teddy Evans of the Morning and Ferrar among the others, Blissett and Weller among the men. Incredibly, Royds and Scott were actually taken to court and fined £5 for shooting cattle on Enderby Island in the Auckland Islands while waiting for the other ships to rendezvous. Although running wild, they had no idea that the cattle were private property. It's and again, you know, we don't sort of think about these things, but the Discovery itself is going to have to be fixed up and ready to go. And I'm quite touched by the fact that his crew members wrote to his mother.
Yeah,
you know, they wanted his family to know what such a good man he was.
Yeah, that's very touching, that is, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it's the sort of loyalty that comes as that's earned loyalty rather than the sort of sycophantic loyalty that people that are promoted above their own ability very often insist upon from the people that work under them.
Yeah, it's just a really good thing to think of doing, isn't it? As for the scientists' work, the collections went to the British Museum of Natural History and their statistical material to the Royal Society. Upon arrival in England, all the scientists went their separate ways. Wilson worked on his huge collection at the Natural History Museum, and he never went back to medical practice. The servicemen had no problems with future employment. They simply slipped back into their regular jobs without any loss of seniority. Royds figured it would take 10 years before a promotion, and he was quite accurate as he did not reach the rank of captain until 1914. Skelton made a brilliant career for himself in the Royal Navy, but it was Scott who pondered his fate as the Discovery sailed from Lyttelton on June 8, 1904. On September 10th, over 3 years after leaving, the Discovery reached Spithead. Sir Clements Markham and his wife were aboard the ship when she steamed into Portsmouth Harbour, where all the men of war and a line of boats sent from Whale Island gave hearty cheers. It was here that Scott learned of his appointment as post-captain, which was to take effect the following day. In his welcoming speech at the East India docks on September 16th, Markham declared, "Never has any polar expedition returned with so great a harvest of scientific results. Truly, this had been the most revealing of all Antarctic exploration, as meticulous records were kept on the scientific work. But Scott could not accept full credit, as he proclaimed that an Antarctic expedition is not a one-man show, not a two-man show, nor a ten-man show. It means the cooperation of all. There has been nothing but a common desire to work for the common good." Scott now moved his mother and two sisters to a house they found at 56 Oakley Street off the Chelsea Embankment, and this was to be Scott's home for 4 years, and it still stands today, marked by a blue commemorative plaque. Initially, Scott received royal thanks, but his only honour was the appointment to Commander of the Victorian Order, a step up from the membership which he already had. Even the press hounded the government, as they felt he should have at least received an Order of the Bath, if not a knighthood.
Yeah, I mean, you consider knighthoods and that are dished out nowadays. I think what Scott did was far more than the people that are ennobled nowadays tend to do.
Far more than a donation to the Tories, isn't it? Which is
that's right.
Yeah, you get made into one of the Lords. An exhibition at the Bruton Galleries opened on November 4th, 1904, which drew an estimated 10,000 visitors. Inside were a collection of Wilson's drawings, Skelton's photographs, a model of the Discovery, sledging equipment, and rations. On November 7th, Scott gave his first big lecture to 7,000 invited members and guests of the two societies at Albert Hall. Now the praise was raining down upon Scott. He was awarded the Patron's Gold Medal of the Royal Geographical Society, was made a member of the French Legion of Honour and the Russian Geographical Society, and received medals from the Geographical Societies of Philadelphia, Denmark, and Sweden. What pleased him most was an honorary degree of Doctor of Science from Cambridge University. When he left London, he headed for Edinburgh for more lectures and the Royal Geographical Society's Livingstone Medal. Shackleton had arranged this, and now the two were on excellent terms. Scott wrote to his mother, "Everyone is very pleased with Shackleton. He is showing great energy and business capacity." Scott travelled with Shackleton to Glasgow and Dundee for more speaking engagements. Meanwhile, Markham pleaded with the government to retain the Discovery for future polar work, but his remarks fell upon deaf ears. She was sold to the highest bidder, the Hudson's Bay Company, for £10,000, about one quarter of her original cost. I'd like to see the Discovery. I don't know if it's still around, or maybe it's wasting away somewhere. Scott continued to travel around the country giving lectures and making preparations to publish a book about the expedition. He wrote, "Of all things, I dread having to write a narrative and am wholly doubtful of my capacity in any event. If I have to do it, it will take me a long time. I have not the pen of a ready writer." By the start of 1905, the book was nearly completed. On October 12th, in an edition of 3,000 copies, The Voyage of the Discovery was published. An incredible piece of work. The two-volume edition was profusely illustrated with Wilson's drawings and Skelton's photographs. Scott needlessly worried about his abilities for writing, as nearly all the critics praised it. The Times Literary Supplement called it a masterly work. His former crew members each received a free copy, and they all loved it. Scott insisted on sending Wilson a cheque for £100 as a fee for reproducing his drawings. Wilson refused, but Scott made him take it anyway. Today, a single drawing can fetch $10,000 or more. The book sold reasonably well. The first edition sold out immediately, so 1,500 more copies were printed the following month. But then the sales fell dramatically when the book went out of print in 1919, Total sales amounted to 5,272 copies. And it says here, try to find one. Scott was a little concerned with Armitage's newly published book, 2 Years in the Antarctic, which also came out in the autumn of 1905, but he wrote nothing derogatory about his former leader. I'm amazed at that. The total sales, 5,000 copies. I mean, what that really says to me is that there really weren't that many people that actually read books back then.
Yeah, that could well be the case. I would have thought that worldwide there would have certainly been, or even nationwide, there certainly should have been more people that would have bought copies than that. But if it was partway through the First World War, then lots of men who perhaps would have been of an adventurous spirit and who volunteered to go off and fight would have been preoccupied with fighting. 1919, it's just after the First World War, isn't it?
And it came out in 1905. Came out in 1905.
Oh, 1905, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, so in 1919, perhaps, the total sales were just 5,000 copies. That was all. Total sales out of all of them.
Yeah, well, so between 1905 and 1919, what I would say does hold, really, that would have been the period that the First World War would have been fought in, albeit it started in 1914. But the point is that, perhaps the sort of people who would have liked to have read that book would have been preoccupied with the war for some of that period of time, and perhaps preoccupied with other things. I don't know. It just seems strange, doesn't it?
Well, it's nice to see that he's finally getting all these awards as well, and he's made into an honorary scientist, and that he credits it all to his men.
Yeah, when you said about how he had delivered a lecture to 7,500 people from the Royal Society, etc., that my mind immediately flicked to, what sort of location could you assemble 7,500 people? And obviously the Albert Hall, and I've been to the Albert Hall on quite a few occasions and seen various to conferences that have been held there, or to concerts that have been held there, and it is a fantastic building. And you can just imagine, can't you, being on the stage in the Albert Hall as Scott delivering a lecture, where you're telling all these people about the all the entertaining things, really, that you've been saying to me over the last few weeks, the stuff that's made us laugh. I don't know whether Scott would have gone into that sort of detail about them, all the sort of the mechanics of taking their sweaty boots off and stuff, and putting them somewhere so they didn't freeze overnight and all that sort of stuff. You can just imagine it. People would have been gripped, wouldn't they, listening to that sort of thing?
Yeah, it would have been really quite nerve-wracking as well, I should imagine, speaking in front of 7,000 people. I mean, it's quite an incredible story. I mean, he certainly well deserves to be up there in our greatest Britons. And there's more to his life as well, which we'll probably get into in the next episode, but I think we shall leave that here for today. Thank you very much for listening, and keep an eye out for more in our Greatest Britain series, where we will be talking about Captain Scott and the Terra Nova expedition.